Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today, we are joined by John Paris and Ben Coleman to talk about the campaign for military innovation, how it is going, and what can be done to improve it. Remember to bother everyone you know until they listen to the show. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Xbox Music, and Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and give us 5 stars. We think Sea Control is a fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is reporting your movements to North Korean spies. You should report them to the suited man sitting outside your house in that fake construction bed. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab for the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your host, Matt Hipple, the editor of Next War. I am here with Ben Coleman and John Paris. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having us here.
If you can each introduce yourselves to the audience, I'm sure most of the folks listening already know who you are, but for the ones just joining us, this will help them out.
Sure. John Paris, I'm a lieutenant, a surface warfare officer, just finishing up my shore duty now and heading back to sea starting in January in the department head pipeline.
I'm Ben, Lieutenant Ben Coleman, call sign PROC from the F-18 community, currently a speechwriter for Fleet Forces and helping out on some off-the-record innovation efforts with the DOD, as well as being a member of the CNO Rapid Innovation Cell. And just note that all the things that both John and I are saying tonight are not the position of the Department of Defense, but to coin a phrase from Matt Hipple, we wish they were. So, Matt, over to you.
Well, perfect. That means I don't have to add in the disruptive little tagline I put at the beginning of each one. Now, before we get into the actual discussion between you two gentlemen, just for everyone's reference, tonight's discussion is going to be about what is innovation in the Navy and how do we cultivate it without killing it. Each of you, if you could shortly discuss the innovation culture or project or whatever you might want to call it. Ben, to start with you, then John, how did each one of you get involved in it?
So our path there was a little bit circuitous and definitely not through official channels. One of the things that I've been thinking about over the past couple of years is our military sufficiently staffed and oriented towards solving the very complex and, to steal a phrase, wicked problems of the 21st century? And I would contend in a lot of ways we're a 20th century model, kind of modeled on industrial age thinking that isn't as well suited to the information age as it could. The system evolved to be the way it is for very good reason, and there are certainly reasons for why things are the way they are. But with new threats emerging, with new paradigms coming to the fore, I really believe that a fundamental alteration has to occur in the way that we are bringing up junior officers and even how we're prosecuting wars and other national security concerns if we want to remain relevant in the 21st century. And integral to that is developing solutions that may not necessarily be in the standard bureaucratic structure. So I've had a chance to put together a couple organizations on the outside of the Navy while also building one inside the Navy. The first two are Disruptive Thinkers and the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. And Disruptive Thinkers really emerged from a conversation I had over beers one day with a friend of mine who is a lieutenant in the Navy now, but he had spent 10 years prior in government service both at the Pentagon and White House briefing senior staff members as a 25-year-old on very significant national security concerns. And one of the things he noticed was that as a civilian in a suit and tie at 25 years of age, he was able to have significant impact and influence on how national security was implemented in the government. But as soon as he took off that civilian outfit and put on the uniform of United States Navy ensign, and he did it for very good reasons, all of his years of experience and educational attainment that he had subsequent to that was thrown out the window. He was just viewed as another ensign in the pool that really had nothing to contribute to the fight. And he and I were wondering, what can junior officers today do to bring a spirit of innovation and have an impact on the broader national security culture? How can we help shape the conversation? And from that, we determined that we should look to our peers who, of a similar age and experience level, have in fact been able to influence the conversation. And those are entrepreneurs and innovators. And while we're not here to debate whether the military is a business or not, because I will be the first to say it's certainly not, I think there are lessons to be learned from people like Michael Dell and Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and a slew of other entrepreneurs who made their name when they were 30 years and below and literally shaped the world to what we see today. And I think that we are losing out on incredible potential of some of our junior members, and we need to find a way to harness those. So Disruptive Thinkers really came about from that idea. It was simply a five-person gathering in my living room in San Diego talking about some books we found of interest, looking at some TED Talks, some articles. And from there, it really grew to encompass an entire ecosystem within the Southern California region. There's also a chapter now in Austin and D.C. But what we really discovered from the military side was that innovators just needed a place to come and talk and find each other, and that's where the defense entrepreneurs were born out of. But from this concept, the Chief Naval Operations Rapid Innovation Cell was formed, which allowed 15 junior officers to take on some project with funding and support that they could have influence with, that some very high-level individuals would help support them through the process and push their innovative ideas into the mainstream and hopefully get them implemented. We've run into quite a few bureaucratic hurdles and also some philosophical issues as we tried to implement this. I wouldn't say we're a completely successful organization, at least the CRIC isn't at this point. We have a ways to go, but I think there are some significant things we're doing that's starting to change the conversation in some very particular areas we'll get into later. That's kind of my background, and I really think that we as a generation, like all previous generations, have some significant contributions to make, and we shouldn't be overlooked when policymakers are creating national policy.
All right, perfect. John, looks like Ben's already jumped into a little bit of framing, so if you could give your background, how sure. You started becoming interested in the whole innovation project in the Navy, and a little bit of framing on your part, too, where you're coming from with your perspective.
Sure. Yeah, I would say that I think just like, and you can, you know, you can certainly relate just as Ben can. I think, I first became particularly interested in it, you know, on sea duty, sitting out there, hitting the frustrations that we all see in the fleet, you know, the things that we shake our fists at and, you know, and, wonder why we can't change them. The publications that are out of date or that don't apply to a particular situation, the solutions that our guys are finding, that are out of regs, but work better than the regs. So I certainly, was frustrated by all that and, certainly probably lived outside the law on a few occasions, to get things done. But that's, you know, everybody does that out there and that's just the way it is, which is probably part of the greater problem, but I didn't have a name for it or anything like that. And, certainly went on to shore duty. And I suppose that I got tied into this innovation campaign, so to speak, through my current job. And, certainly, as Ben pointed out, I want to caveat that, that a lot of the perspective I've gained and a lot of the stuff that forms my arguments here comes from a job of probably some sensitivity in there being a flag aide, but, you know, working at the Navy Warfare Development Command and getting to see, innovation campaign up close and personal. And certainly these are my opinions, but the stuff that I've shared with the boss and I've gotten to see stuff. And, I think I even got tied into it further, you know, probably through Ben. I like to stake a kind of semi-humorous claim that I was able to get Ben tied into some of the Navy stuff because I read one of his articles. So, you know, I read about disruptive thinkers and I thought, hey, this is fantastic stuff. And I really agreed with what they're doing. And I sent it to the boss. I sent it to the admiral and I said, hey, look at what this guy's doing. And, he yelled out at me, get that guy out here. And, you know, we went from there, started with a Facebook message and, you know, Ben's done a lot of great stuff there. And, I think the angle that I'm coming from is that we can't force innovation. We can't, push it out there. And what's really rubbed me the wrong way and a lot of the things I've seen in the past couple of years is, the Navy pushing out there another campaign, just like, you know, the anti-drinking and anti-trafficking in persons and all the other various campaigns that we get to see and sit through training on. They're pushing out innovation in that way. And I don't think that's, the right way to go about it. And I also think it misses the point in that innovations out there happening right now all the time. And the reason, and as Ben brought up, you know, we find ourselves stuck in a bureaucracy and a 20th century organization and all that, is that is the Navy's not listening. And I don't think I think the reason why innovation gets squashed so much is because people think, why will I even bother with the Navy? Why am I going to push things out there? Because they're just going to say no anyways, which is why a lot of the things that we do, a lot of the innovations that we come up with, stay on the ships or in the squadrons, because they never get farmed out because the Navy's just going to say no. And what I'm kind of pushing out there is, hey, let's not have another hollow, empty campaign that everybody's going to roll their eyes out. Let's just cultivate a culture that says we're going to listen to what people are out there doing, and we're going to implement the good ideas, and we're not going to just automatically say no. And that's quite a mountain to come over as it is. But kind of how I'm trying to push this out there and define things is that innovation is identifying a problem and then coming up with a new solution to that problem. Okay. Whereas I try to differentiate that from creativity, which is just kind of sitting around thinking up new ideas. And I think those are two distinct problems that we have to tackle. And I don't think that innovation itself can survive in a bureaucracy. I think it just happens. It happens at the source of the problem, vice through a big Navy program. So that's my take.
All right. Well, that's a pretty good setup. Ben, have you got a response, sort of a perspective on that? What do you think about the campaign versus the culture idea?
Yeah, I'm actually in significant agreement with John here on the campaign issue. I mean, obviously, I think there's incredible value to having a concerted, organized effort to trying to get ideas out there. One of the things that NWDC did this past year was the Reducing Administrative Distractions campaign, which on the face of it yielded literally thousands of ideas and got tens of thousands of sailors involved. They could vote on ideas, they could comment on them. But the real innovations occur when execution is really given the keynote role. And one of my friends, who's a lieutenant commander working up on the Hill these days, he says execution is new innovation. And one of the frustrations that I saw with RAD was there was all this energy around, oh great, we're getting these ideas from the fleet. It's not just a SurveyMonkey survey we spent tens of million dollars on and got a whole bunch of data that, you know, we're going to hide behind a closed door. Everybody could see it. But the problem is, if you don't act on it, and if you don't take very direct steps, and you don't have very high-level four-star support saying, okay, this is a particular issue that's of interest to me, I personally will take charge to make this better, then it almost sets you back two steps. And it's not really engaging where you should. If you're going to crowdsource a solution, you actually have to show significant results from that. And additionally, when you have a separate innovation entity, What that inevitably says to everybody else is you don't have to innovate. Innovation is only at this place, and they are responsible for it. So if you don't innovate, no big deal. But the theme should be cultural. It should be that innovation should be everywhere, and it should be more than a buzzword. It should be the grassroots efforts. And one of the things I like to point to is the Athena Project, which was spearheaded by the USS Benfold, run by Lieutenant Dave Nobles and Commander Rich LeBron. And they just took an idea and ran with it. And they have been empowering sailors for the past year, come up with ideas, and those ideas are found to be worthy as voted on by the crew. They're given time and money to make them happen, and the command supports them 100%. And they're not crazy game-changing ideas or, you know, change our relationship with Iran or China or wherever, any of our adversaries, but it's small things that the junior officers and junior enlisted on the deck plates are seeing that they can take real ownership of and execute. And despite the impact that I think the CRIC is having, I think that even these more grassroots, outside the lifelines efforts that are just created because people see a problem they want to address are really where the true solutions are going to lie in the future. And there has to be a way to support that. And in a lot of ways, they are being supported, but I think they're not being recognized as officially as they could be. But at the same token, maybe that's not a good thing. So I think it's an important discussion to have is how do we want to foster this? But it really comes back to a cultural issue. How do you inculcate the lower ranks to kind of have this just general innovative spirit that when they see a problem has to be addressed, they can address it.
So if I can ask then, if you and John, Ben, and of course I agree with that too, that it is a cultural issue. Ben, then why the crick? I mean, if you do see the an innovation institution as being a crutch, then what is the advantage then of having the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell or the Naval Warfare Development Center itself? I mean, I'm a fan, but here now you're saying that it's possibly a detriment. How do you see that sort of adding together?
So I think detriment is a little bit too strong of a word, and Navy Warfare Development Command has more than just the innovation campaign. They have lessons learned, they have the wargaming part, they have the flex for experimentation, and a whole slew of other things that are providing incredible value to the fleet. And while I think that institutional innovation isn't necessarily the whole ballgame, there is something to be said for giving resources that are on the bottom line of the official entity to people that actually create buy-in, if you will. So I'll use 3D printing as an example. And if it wasn't for the crick, in my opinion, but I think it actually plays out in what's happened, with us advocating for putting a 3D printer on a ship, seeing what the potential could be, it would never have gotten the level of attention it's gotten already. And to some extent, we helped move the needle for some of the naval research organizations that weren't necessarily looking as hard as they could. But when we had funding behind us, when we had official backing, they said, okay, maybe this thing is for real, which we got it harder. And as a result, they elected to do some of their own experiments. And now an OpNav division is actually taking it on for action at the behest of the CNO, which is incredible. And when was the last time a bunch of O3s got together and were able to push an idea to that high of a level and get tasking at that level, push forward and see where the technology could go in the future? I mean, that is what the crick is all about. And you can have these off the record, kind of ad hoc organizations, and they will provide incredible value in the networking and the solutions. But until you have organizational support behind something, the needle doesn't move. An example I like to use is Skunk Works. And Skunk Works, by Mr. Johnson over there at Lockheed Martin, was literally a completely innovative organization that got stuff done. They were given a charter to go completely off the reservation. They were not in the normal chain of command. They had resources that couldn't be touched by anybody else and couldn't be questioned by anybody else to just go experiment and explore. And while a lot of the naysayers said, well, this is not going to have an effective value on our bottom line, they proved through the technology they developed they could do so in that particular environment. And I think that should be the example for large organizations in building an innovation organization that can still exist within the lifelines but have a completely different rule book of its own.
So I think just kind of to come off of one of your earlier points, Ben, about establishing, you know, how do we get people riled up about innovation and how do we get them to feel like they can be innovative? I think that's maybe a fundamental disagreement, or maybe we have a different perspective on it and say, I think they are already innovative. And I think that, and maybe that's where one of the things that rubs me the wrong way about a push from Big Navy is that, and I'm just like Matt and myself, I'm sure you've seen it in the fleet and the squadrons and whatnot, is that folks are coming up with solutions already. I don't think that we're living in the dark ages. I don't think people are just sitting around with their heads down. I think that innovation is happening all around us all the time. That being said, one of the things that I think I kind of chafed at and quite a few other people that I knew chafed at when all this kind of movement started getting revved up is the maybe the perception that we got that Big Navy and some of the other organizations, maybe the crick and it, to an extent, but maybe not so much them, we're saying that we got to be innovative all the time. Why aren't people always innovating? Innovate every day type of stuff. And I don't think that innovation necessarily, at least not by my definition, which only matters to me, is I don't think innovation is just something you do every day. I think innovation has its roots in a problem, an identified hurdle. Hey, this thing isn't working as well as it could or at all. This Big Navy order is out of date. How do we get around it? And then coming up with a solution. A very common one that example that I use just on an everyday basis, at least in the service community, is the way we come up with our watch bills, and the software that the Navy gives us and mandates is pretty clunky. It's pretty bad. It's not user friendly, and if you don't have pretty extensive training on it, it's almost ineffective, but yet that's the watch bill software. And that's what they want to see your watch bills coming out of when inspections come around. But yet people out there said, hey, this software is crap. We're going to come up with a better way. They use Excel more often than not from what I've seen. And, they come up with watch bills. They're still able to track quals. And they get the job done better and more efficiently. They improve life, but they fail inspections because they've used the improper, watch bill software. And that's where I think we run into the problem of, hey, people are being innovative out in the fleet, but then they're losing a little bit of hope because they get crushed by the organization saying no. So I don't think people are just sitting around doing nothing. I think people are being innovative when it matters and when it's necessary. But I also think they're doing their jobs every day, and I don't think they sit around and say, hey, I got to innovate something. I got to come up with something new all the time. Sometimes the regs do work, and sometimes the pubs are up to date, and our instructions and our doctrine matter, and we don't have to just change up new things every day. And I think we probably agree to that point to an extent there. But I think what's important is establishing a culture with our leadership that says, hey, you know what? We're going to listen to those innovations that come out of the fleet. Rather than sitting around saying, we need people to be more innovative, we want to say, hey, let's listen to the people that are being innovative, and let's implement those solutions. Let's publicize them. I think that's where we spin our wheels a little bit and we miss the mark.
Everything you said, I don't disagree with at all. I mean, disruptive thinkers and the crick and death, all these things we created because we saw that the fleet was innovative. We saw that people by their very nature were coming up with incredible solutions. And one of the things that you talk about, and I completely agree, is the development of the combat iPad, taking 20 pounds of pubs, paper version, having to flip through those in a Huey is a lot harder than putting it simply on a movie map software that you can put on your kneeboard and flip through with the ease of an iPhone. People are coming up with these every day.
Sure.
But the thing that I think that the crick and the official kind of moniker gives is that hope that, you kind of allude to. We put out applications this summer for 7 new crick members. And we got 65 applications. And even for those that didn't make the cut, and I'm going to digress here and say that I hated the fact that we had to make specific choices on who would be an innovator, because that in my mind is ridiculous. But obviously you have funding constraints, you have other issues that need to limit that. But every single person that didn't make it, they said, you know what, it was worth it for me to apply, because for the first time in my Navy career, I realized there were others out there who were like me that were having these ideas, and the fact that I now have an avenue and now have an outlet to get these things out there makes me feel very good, and it gives me hope for the future. And external organizations, yes, you're going to give hope to these people. Things like the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, where people come together on a weekend in Chicago, at the University of Chicago, with business school professors and officers from across the services to talk about these ideas are great. But until you have an official channel where you have the CNO saying, I want ideas from the deck plates and I will fund them, that sends an incredible message to the deck plates, to the commanding officers, to major commanders, to even department heads, to say, if the CNO thinks it's important, maybe we should think about this as well. Maybe we should start harnessing the creative ideas. And even if it is once a year, allow our sailors to have an avenue to push actionable ideas forward. And it doesn't have to be official. Again, I think unofficial, as we've discussed, is the way to go. And that's the way you get true innovation. But when you get senior leaders saying this is important to us, that can't help but have an incredible cultural effect. And it's only one piece of the puzzle, but it's in a very important part of it.
If I can ask a question of both of you, something that John brought up, and Ben, I think, is probably on your mind, the idea of let's talk about that inspection, where they're not using the correct program and they fail. We've all seen it in one shape or another where an inspecting body will come on board and say, hey, you did a great job, but you didn't do this one thing, so you failed, or we'll let you do it again. And you ask, well, wait a minute, if I did a great job and I clearly succeeded, why is this something that's important? Then my question would be, are we perhaps discussing it the wrong way? Is the issue not so much we need these institutions or even a culture? Should it generally be that we have taken far too much authority from people on the deck plates to be allowed to solve these problems? I mean, yes, it's great. We want to be able to spread around best practices, but have we done too much? And I'm sure you'll both agree with that point. we've done possibly too much to enforce those best practices into every situation where they're not necessarily appropriate. What do each one of you see as the future of this project? What do you see as that future culture? What do you see as that future environment? Should we still have the really in-depth inspections and practices, and we have that direct red phone to the top where you can change them rapidly, or should we decentralize it more, which doesn't require that red phone, but rather allows folks to come up with the decisions on your own? And Ben, you just went, so I'll throw it over to John first so we can get you guys a nice even perspective from both of you.
Sure. So like you predicted, I certainly agree that we've taken it away from them. This is probably about the most libertarian you're going to ever hear me get. But yeah, I definitely think Big Navy is crushing the innovators, the job creators out there. But I think that the future, the way ahead with that, one thing I've been trying to propose and kind of making an argument on in a few different forums and probably more than my boss would prefer in his office is we need just to have the listening culture. I agree with Ben that things like the Crick can inspire hope out there, but I tend to disagree, and I'm not going to be confrontational here, but I disagree that that's really doing all that much. I think that it would do a lot more out there to listen to the folks in the fleet, and it doesn't have to be through an official, like the RAD campaign or the Crick or the Mowgli war games that have been going out there, which all tend to annoy me for one reason or another. It just has to be, hey, captains, commodores, fleet commanders, type commanders, whatnot, the folks that are making the decision. If folks out there have a good idea and they forward it up to you, we expect you to listen to it. And if it makes sense, we expect you to implement it. And if you implement it, we expect you to publicize it. And I think those steps right there, the listening, the implementation, and the publicizing it, are all probably equally critical. And they all happen at the very end of this innovation loop that I'm kind of proposing. The vast majority of it happens there on the deck plate, where the folks, where our Marine captain out there flying in Afghanistan decided that, he was going to put all of his charts on an iPad, or the Sanjak folks came up with a new workday and a new watch bill. And I think a perfect example that I'll bring up that I've been talking with some folks around the office with is lately the Navy on, Navy.mil put out an article about the HTs on GW coming up with this new contraption. They called it the Octopus. To fill up water jugs during the Philippines disaster relief. They needed to fill up more water jugs at a time. They needed them to be far enough off the deck so they could fit the water jugs. And they came up with this octopus looking contraption that filled up 8 jugs at a time. It was far enough off the deck, and it was very innovative because it solved this problem because they weren't moving water fast enough. My exact definition of innovation. And it was great. It was front page on the Navy website. And a couple days later, out there in the Navy blogosphere, guy came out and said, hey, this isn't innovative at all. Look at the Navy publication from the Indonesia, disaster response, and then the Japan disaster response, and I think he even brought up the Haiti one. So like 3 past carriers of the 3 past HADR missions we've done all came up with almost exactly the same thing. Not perfectly in every way, but exactly enough. It shows that the HTs were all thinking along the same lines. But none of them knew about the previous guy coming up with that thing. They all were presented with a problem. Hey, we can't fill up enough jugs at a time. Can you come up with something? And they all came up with essentially the same thing after tinkering with it. And it was innovative, and it was a big deal. And the Navy publicized it. The Navy actually put it on their front page like 3 or 4 times now. I have to go back and read the article. But the point is that we're missing that loop. Is that while they might have listened to it in the moment, hey, you've come up with this great thing, thank you very much, we're going to go use it in disaster relief, they didn't implement it, didn't make it into any pubs, it didn't make it into HTA school, it didn't make it into the HADR manual that the Carrier Strike Group commander is using, and they didn't they didn't publicize it out there, it didn't make it into Navy lessons learned, it didn't make it out there so that other guys weren't coming up with recreating the wheel each time. I think that's kind of where we need to go from from here?
Well, John, to that, I would just say that that almost calls for a centralized innovation campaign to get those lessons learned, disseminate them, which I think NWDC was trying to do to some extent. Now, I'm the last person to advocate for centralized authority for anything, but you almost need somebody that someone with an innovative idea can come to and say, this is my idea, put it in a repository that, you know, if it's an HT, if it's an AMP, if it's an HADR mission, I, if I'm going over there, can pull from that and say, what did they do in the past? And that has to be organized at a large scale. But I understand what you're saying, and I think for the most part it's right on. But I want to get back to Matt's question, and I think the important thing to understand is that everything we do right now, specifically with inspections, has a reason. Now, the reason may have evolved, but we have a saying in aviation that the NATOPS, which is our kind of guidebook to systems and safety and the kind of the way we do things, is written in blood. Every single thing in there, every single emergency procedure, every single thing that we have, somebody died at some point, and so a rule was written.
Sure.
And when you look at inspections, I mean, even though we have an ungodly amount and they keep piling on there, somebody somewhere, it wasn't just Big Navy, it was a particular person with a particular name, a particular title, decided to take that action for a reason. And a lot of this is honestly politically driven. And I think we in the military forget a lot of times that, and this goes back to Clausewitz, is that we are a politically driven entity. War is just another means of politics. And when something happens, look at the Sapper stuff. When we have a raft of sexual assaults, Congress is going to ask us for a solution. And the solution we come up with is going to be one that is, to some of us, onerous, to others of us, very effective in fixing the problem. And when you get those things piled on top of each other, then you see this individual tree as being really terrible, but you don't realize what the backstory is on it. And I think everything happens for a reason. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't revisit it, but there's incredible cost in taking something away, because mission command really is risky. And this is what we're talking about. We're talking about devolving authority to the lowest possible level. And if we really want to embrace a mission command mindset, which is kind of all the rage right now, there are going to be some failures. There are going to be some really front page news things where a commander goes rogue and tries to do something risky and fails. And we don't have a system right now that absorbs failure very well. And I think a good historical instruction here is a book that I actually read when I was a senior in college called The Rules of the Game. And it talks about how Lord Nelson created amongst his subordinates this incredible trust, so much so that when he died at the Battle of Trafalgar, his commanders intuitively knew what he wanted and were able to execute his orders to the T and win the battle. But as the British Navy evolved over the next 100 years, those mission command kind of evolutionary orders solidified and evolved into very strict procedures, such that when they got to the Battle of Jutland, even though theoretically they were still under that mindset of Lord Nelson, they were so in the mindset of doing things the way they had to be done, they couldn't think outside the box and lost to the Germans. And I think in a lot of ways we have these inspections and structures that have been created to fill gaps as a one-off solution to a particular issue. And taken at a very micro scale, they make sense. But if you aggregate them all together, it causes this incredible weight to be placed on the individual operator that the individual stakeholders don't understand the impact of all of them collectively. And when you say, okay, let's get rid of IA training and make it more feasible. Well, to the N6, you absolutely need it the way it is, because there are threats out there that are going to threaten us. But to the N1 or to the N8 or something like that, there's something that's taken away from other warfighter responsibilities. So there has to be a whole system of systems approach to what we're doing. And unfortunately, we are so stovepiped in our current bureaucracy that the different end codes don't know what the others are doing in a lot of cases and don't see what the effect of it is. And I'll give a lot of credit here to my current command at Fleet Forces. What they're doing with the readiness kill chain, I think, is incredible. When I first got there, I thought it was just this acronym that was, you know, something else a four-star wanted to push down that didn't mean anything. But the more I look into it, what they're trying to do is basically bring all these stakeholders into alignment with each other, saying, this is our end state. Our end state is not INSERV. Our end state is not some other inspection. Our end state is not this random thing. Our end state is forward deployed forces. We're going to look back all the way through this kill chain and figure out what process is required to make this all happen and bring all the end codes, bring every single person to the table and say, this is my problem. How does the thing I'm doing affect you? And how can we make this work out such that even though my part might be smaller, as long as it gets me to a forward deployed warfighting capable force, that's the end goal. And I think that's an important step to look at, and something that all of us could do better on the ship level, at the major command level, at the fleet level, et cetera, to kind of take a holistic approach to these inspections and say, they're there for a reason, but what is that ultimate reason? How do we fit them in?
Okay, yeah, no, I'll jump in there and say, I definitely agree with you. I think that you bringing up the part about instructions, NATOPs and whatnot being written in blood, absolutely, and we have the, you know, the same stuff in the surface side. I would probably say that everybody uses that, and I think that's something good to keep in mind. And I'm actually supportive of, or I say that now until I'm back on the ship next year, but I'm actually supportive of a lot of the inspections out there because I do think they have value. And like you said, a lot of the people that are kind of wanking the most about them have maybe not the full perspective and the full picture. So I think that is important to consider. Something that that I want to bring up is that I don't think, as far as innovation in the fleet is concerned, is I don't think that, I don't think that things need to change all that much. I think they are kind of where they need to be at the lower levels. I think that, in the fleet, on the ships, in the squadrons and whatnot, I think that folks are already doing it. What I think does need to change is that backside of the process where the Navy kind of picks up on it and approves it. Now, I'll be the first to admit I don't have the perfect solution to how, the conduit, so to speak. How do we get that? If it's just routing a chit up to your Commodore and saying, hey, Commodore, I think we ought to use red headlamps on the quartermaster table instead of these stupid flashlights. Or like our combat iPad with the Cobras out in Afghanistan did. They faced hurdles and all that. I'm not exactly sure how that needs to be. But you brought up a good point about lessons learned. And I think that plays a role in the innovation side. And the role I think it plays is that last step that I talked about, the publicizing it. Letting other people know about the innovation that happened so that everybody else doesn't have to innovate, kind of like our successive carriers and their HTs had to do. And, I think we're missing the mark on that. And I say that with the proper degree of respect in that, I sit down the hall from Navy Lessons Learned, and they do good work there. But having been out there in the fleet, especially as my time as a navigator and all that, we used a very small portion of Lessons Learned. And that was usually the port calls and said, hey, what did the last people do in this port? And so that we could figure it out. Not really, innovation stuff, but I think there's a lot to be learned in there. That we could put in the lessons learned, but we're not. And we're, even recently I did a search query and just searched Navy and Navy Lessons Learned and came up with zero hits. that's the kind of stuff. So we're missing that loop. So that was a good thing to bring up. I wanted to kind of bring up a point that was in the original Small Wars Journal article by Michael Christman about the combat iPad. And he said, in regards to the Marine Corps, and I certainly think it applies to us too, it says, don't forget that the Marine Corps is a warfighting institution, not a think tank. And I think that's important to remember. He says that the Marine Corps isn't an organization like Google that requires constant innovation out of its employees. And he kind of related it to McDonald's and saying that everybody expects to be able to get the same kind of hamburger in McDonald's in New York or Tokyo. And in the Marine Corps, you can expect that every battalion, every squadron or whatnot is going to perform in exactly the same way. And I think we have that with our standards. You have that with NATOPS and all the training you guys do out in Fallon and whatnot and everywhere else. And we have that to one degree or another in the surface fleet, probably more in some ways than we'd wish. But we have that. I think that we can get weighted down by saying, hey, we're going to do the same thing all the time. And that kind of weighs down disruptive thinking and innovation. But that's something important, at what makes us good at our jobs is sometimes we just need to do our jobs and not try to, be the constant good idea fairies as we talk about in the fleet so much.
Well, you hit an important point when it comes to innovation in combat. And I think everything we do has to have direct warfighting application, because if it doesn't, then the innovation is worthless when it comes to specific naval applications. But I would argue that over the past 10 years, the generation of officers that has been overseas on the ground, especially in the Marine Corps and Army, and I would primarily focus this on the junior ranks, but I think there are significant senior leaders who've done this as well, is they are the most innovative generation of military officers we have seen in decades, probably maybe in centuries. I'd say we are probably some of the most innovative because of the environment we faced in Afghanistan and Iraq. Sure. And I based that on the fact that when we got over there, the war that we were trained to fight was not the war we actually had to fight. And that wasn't because we had insufficient training. It's because we didn't have any training to deal with the situation on the ground over there. So we had 26-year-old lieutenants and captains facing societal and cultural issues that they couldn't imagine when they had been trained at TBS and infantry school on how to do fire maneuver tactics. But they had to bring together cultures. They had to bring together religions. They had to bring together economic concerns. They had to bring together political concerns and sit down with tribal leaders and figure out how to basically pacify regions and make them self-sustaining from a very low level. And that engenders, inherent innovation. And so I think that on the ground, warfighting is actually the place where the most innovations come to fruition. One of the things the Navy, in particular the surface Navy or submarine Navy, hasn't had in the past 50 years is a near peer adversary that they've actually had to fight and innovate on the fly with. And that's a great blessing. The fact that we haven't lost anybody in combat is incredibly valuable. But even for aviators who are flying close air support missions over Afghanistan, tactics have evolved very rapidly over the past 10 years because they have been faced with on the ground reality. And I give great credit to the U.S. military in general, because when it comes to those warfighting things, even though it might take 2 or 3 years for a torpedo to be changed from, you know, a dud to an actually effective weapon, at least there is a process in place where guys are dying on the ground to change those things. And far and away better than any other military in the world, I would argue, with the exception of a couple, we are able to integrate those. But when those guys who are doing the on-the-ground innovating in Afghanistan and Iraq and flying close air support and et cetera come back to garrison and are placed in an in-CONUS environment where all the things that they were allowed to do overseas in a very dynamic, deadly environment has suddenly been rescinded from them, that's where the frustration kind of sets in. That's where the rule and the kind of the peacetime military takes over. And we have to find a way to bridge the gap between the inherent nature of a peacetime military to kind of promote those who follow the rules with those that we have to promote, such that whatever war we face is going to be against an adversary we can't predict. And it's going to take those really diverse, dynamic thinkers who aren't going to be the ones who get the glowing fit reps to lead us into battle, who can innovate on the fly and really get the job done. And that's where the cultural piece comes into play. And I think that right now is the perfect time to do that. We have all these resources from guys who did this on the ground. We should be inculcating our entire next generation of junior leaders in this mindset of creative thinking and innovative thinking and kind of creating solutions for themselves and giving them hard problems to tackle, such that when they actually have to tackle them in, whether it be in Africa or Asia or Europe or wherever, they don't have the exact solution. They know how to think like that. They know how to apply those principles and can toy and risk new ideas to make the job work.
That's a great point. I think that's probably one of the things we have to come up with is how do we harness that? How do we harness the things that our young leaders have experienced out there in combat, that operational experience that we haven't seen since, you know, I guess Vietnam, really, you know, for an extended period of time. You know, we haven't seen that. And, you know, now we have over a decade of it, you know, sitting at home. I completely agree with you that it atrophies, when they get home and they go into staff jobs or, you know, the variety of things that don't require you to, you know, think or die, basically. You know, those are great points. And how do we harness that? And I think personally, you know, that's kind of the argument I'm making is that we, you know, we promote that culture. And I don't know if the way we do it is we identify them, through fit reps and whatnot, and we make them the generals and the admirals, so that spirit doesn't die and so that we don't all turn into the department heads and COs that we, you know, that we hate, you know, that are the old man that only do it by the book and can never think outside the box. Or, you know, how do we get there? Or if we do a bunch of cricks, I'm not exactly sure how we get there, but I think the best approach is more of a hands-off approach, to just let people out there and think and do. And I think the reason things atrophy and that things die out when they come back home, you know, when, you know, off of deployment and whatnot is because, as you pointed out, you know, when it's not life or death situation, we say by the book, this is the instruction, yada, 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 you got to do it this way. And I don't care what you have to say about your convoluted, you know, young kid idea out there. You know, you might have worked in Afghanistan, but this is Kansas, or, you know, this is Norfolk, you know, completely does not make sense at all, but that's the way things are, and that's how we all know they work, and it's ridiculous, and I think that's what kind of kills it. And I think maybe it'll take some years, you know, until we kind of clean house there, you know, towards the top, and sorry to all the people that at the top that might be listening to that, but adios. But you know, we gotta get folks in there that aren't gonna just say no.
Well, and I think you raise a great point. What I'm focused on with the curriculum is project based, absolutely, get ideas, get senior leaders involved. But when we talk about disruptive thinker, we talk about DAP, we talk about the whole military innovation movement, my focus is not on the 05s, 06s, and 07s. If they want to play, absolutely, and there have been incredible supporters that we've had that we couldn't have done what we've done without their help. But if we really want to create this culture, it has to start at the very beginning. And the great thing about the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum was we had about 90% of the attendees were under the rank of 04. We had enlisted personnel there. We had members of the service academies there who were participating in our conversations. And even though it's not going to bring a solution 2, 3, 4 years down the road, what we envision is 20 or 30 years down the road, when these guys are the 06s and these girls are the 07s, these guys are the ones in the position to make significant decisions, they have been so inculcated in this culture of innovation and this idea of thinking through new problems and being exposed to companies that are changing the world and ideas that are changing the world, that they can't help but think of how to be more effective as innovative leaders. And one of the examples I'll use is the military does a great thing by introducing flag officers at the 06 and 07 level to energy efficiency. One of the things the Naval Postgraduate School hosts is they have guys like Dr. Amory Lovins out from the Rocky Mountain Institute to give senior leaders very specific ideas on where the revolution in energy is going. But what I would argue is that it's almost more effective and cost effective to bring in young 02s and 03s to sit in those conversations. Because while the senior leader might have 10 years left in uniform and then he's out because of higher tenure and other political concerns, that 02 and 03, no matter what happens, he's going to have at least 20 more years in the service. And those ideas that are implanted in his head, he'll be thinking about for 10 or 15 years, 20 years. He won't need a seminar like that when he's a senior leader to finally introduce him to those ideas. No, he'll be thinking about those, engaging with peers on those ideas, reading articles about that, such that when he's in a position of authority, he will just reflexively and instinctively know what to do with it and say, you know what, this is how I want to change the Navy. This is what I think we should do based on this understanding I have of this new technology that I've lived with for decades and decades on. And I think we really need, and this is where the outside organizations come into play. It doesn't have to be an official thing, but if we can focus on the young folks, if we can get them to think about what are the architects thinking about design theory? What are biomimicry engineers looking at when it comes to technology and emulating how nature is doing business? What are some of the tech companies doing with social media that could engage my peers better? If we can get them thinking along those lines as opposed to rote military tactics, we'll have an incredible advantage going forward, and they will have decades to kind of inculcate and develop that mindset.
I wish it was easier, and I wish that the approach to it was more obvious. I think your ideas are great, and I think that things like the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum and Disruptive Thinkers are the right ways. I think that people getting out there and writing, or just even reading, you know, participating in the blogs and kind of getting out there and going to some of these forums are good ways to do it. I suppose that the thing that I don't like the most is it coming from the Navy? Is it coming from the organization? I suppose this is my cynical SWO side coming out, you know, of I don't want to hear it, Navy. You know, I don't need you to tell me to be innovative. I don't need you to cultivate my innovation. I'm being innovative already when it matters. And so in there, I know I recognize that my argument gets a little wrapped around semantics and maybe it's probably more my problem than anybody else's. But that's where I think we need to look at it. You know, and I'm not necessarily convinced that the younger people, the 01s, 02s, and maybe some of the junior 03s need a lot of lecturing, need a lot of, you know, the schoolhouse type of stuff, or even, you know, the forums and whatnot, saying, hey, why don't you think about these things? I'm blown away by it. You know, I participate, you know, in my little bit of free time, I go over and I teach at the Baby Swass here in Norfolk. And the guys, these guys are going to be my divos in a year or so or less. And, they're already smarter than I was. And that's tough for me to admit. Just a few years ago, they're already, you know, they're brilliant. They're thinking about stuff, you know, that I would never have thought about. They're tied into things you know, primarily through the internet, no less, that I have to catch up on. So there are already smart out there. I think that we establish that culture externally and say, hey, you know, keep in touch with, what folks are doing on the outside. I think what you've been doing with disruptive thinkers and kind of what you're proposing now about tying in, business and, just the private sector and whatnot and other government organizations and comparing that to how we do practices in the Navy or just the military in general is fantastic. And I think that's really important. And I think that it's best served when it's outside the Navy. And I say that primarily, again, like I said, the cynical side. I think we roll our eyes more often than not when it's coming from the Navy. And I think it loses, and they might not like to hear this, but, you know, I'm sure everybody understands it. It loses a lot of its effect when it comes with the stamp of the Navy on it. Hey, this is our innovation campaign. You brought it up earlier, the RAD stuff. And as you're aware, that process was being run 5 feet from my desk, you know, in an office 5 from my desk with the Admiral Slansky and all that. And great idea, but it didn't really execute on anything, like you said. Completely lost credibility. And if you see some, I'm sure you've seen some of the stuff and talk with people, and it's just like, well, whatever happened to that? So it comes with the Navy stamp on it. People are automatically a little suspicious of it and are some of the sayings out there with Navy at the end of it in the fleet. And, that's kind of how they say it, you know. So I think keeping the outside stuff is the most important way we can cultivate this innovative spirit.
Maybe let me ask this, because at the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, there was, Nathan Finney, a few others were on the PME, board. And one of the things that came up was, from the other services guys, like, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, and the Army, was that they were very impressed with the way that the Navy does PME at the 06 and above level. But when it comes to professional military education in any arena, it seems that the Navy, especially on the surface warfare side, is just one of the worst. And the question is perhaps when it comes to this culture of innovation, as you say, you know, coming from the Navy and what have you, but could this problem be solved with better JO innovation, or not innovation, I'm sorry, but with better PME for JOs? Because at the end of the day, if you are a person who does nothing but 3M for the first 4 years of your career, or you do those admin processes as a nature of survival, you're not going to become suddenly this brilliant and innovative individual. You'll have been inculcated to a certain point to a way of thinking. It's just natural. You get comfortable in a way of doing things. It's
sure.
It's what people do. Could the Navy solve its innovation problem, if we want to call it a problem, with PME or some sort of process like that?
I think there is a way to do that, and I had the great fortune to go up to the Naval Academy and talk with the leadership and ethics professors about building an innovation syllabus, and they were very receptive to the idea. Some of the things that, you know, we've integrated with Disruptive Thinkers and some of the business we've made with the CRIC, giving them resources in the civilian and government world of folks who can come in and kind of talk to the midshipmen about that. But some of that, I think, is better left to the more informal organizations. And there is certainly interest, but it really comes down to what's the war you're facing. And I think until we can define that, the larger PME institutions will not be able to adapt to specific educational requirements unless they can have something to point to as being effective. I don't see a lot of movement or hope in that regard. I'm actually going through JPME 1 right now. On the strategy and war course. And it's actually kind of interesting, you know, going into Clausewitz and Sun Tzu and all that. But there's, when I go on the discussion forums, it's so formulaic. I don't want to engage. It's not interesting. Like, I would rather go on Twitter or Facebook and banter back and forth with y'all about some crazy article I read about, you know, some adversary we might have and throw ideas back and forth and apply all the lessons we've learned from our myriad of science fiction readings and understanding of economics and philosophy. Then only be able to cite the specific tests in a very academic environment that, while very useful foundationally, where's the there? Like, okay, great, I understand the theory behind it, but give me some case studies that I can really delve into. Bring in a commanding officer of a destroyer who's doing counter-piracy off Somalia and say, this is my situation. Apply the lessons from Clausewitz and Sun Tzu to this environment. What would you do? Okay, this is what I did. This is what I could have done differently, et cetera. Like, that to me is PME. I mean, you know, people razz on business school, but their case study method is rooted in actual reality. They bring in CEOs from companies that have dealt with very difficult situations, and they say, you know what? We screwed up. This is how we could have done better. That's what PME should be, is bring in operational commanders to talks, and maybe this happens at the War College level, and I hope it does, but at least in the online course, it's all reading and regurgitation and just not a lot of fun interaction, which our generation thrives on.
Yeah. It's only a lot of reading if you do it, just so you
right.
know.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of a rule follower, ironically, but. Yeah.
No, I know.
Now, you guys are doing, loop jobs. For those who don't know, loop means that you're being a flag aide.
Well, I'm not a loop.
Well, I know you're not a loop, but yeah, you've done a lot of loop type engagements. John, you of course, have your loop. Now, you guys have seen some of that JPMEs, have seen guys going through these processes. Being a little further along, in the process than a guy who just put on his railroad tracks like me, the possibility of, say, JPME, making something that you did in college count. I always find it interesting, Ben, how you're talking about Clausewitz. And I think about it, I was like, for those of us that did poli-sci, you know, the Navy is sort of bringing the hammer down on folks with poli-sci degrees. But they talk about Clausewitz. Is I took 3 or 4 classes that had to do with Clausewitz. Is there a possibility, or is another answer to this, advancing people based on what they take in college? So if you have things in engineering, they count it towards your engineering once you get into the service, if you do take a mechanical engineering course or something that covers diesels and steam power. Or if you come into the Navy and, let's say, you've done a degree in international security, they say, hey, we have these certain requirements for JPME. You're already 50% done. You haven't done this other 50%, and now here's the part where you're being introduced to new material. Is that a solution, or do you think that's a little bit too decentralized, maybe not as controlled as the Navy requires?
Well, for me, I think that you might be onto something, but I'll offer just a slight different perspective. I agree with you that I think innovation would be better off if we were more specialized. And I say that at least from our perspective. You know, if you and I in the SWO community, obviously Ben doesn't have to worry about that as much because he is specialized, you know, in what he does, at least out in the fleet. You know, Ben's not expected to be a C-130 pilot and a loadmaster, and a helicopter pilot and, you know, an F-18 pilot and an E-2 air controller and all the other good stuff. He's got a job, unless I'm mistaken, Ben. but I mean, you're an F-18 pilot. You know how to land an F-18 on an aircraft carrier, not a COD. You know how to do all your combat maneuvers in an F-18 and not the air controlling the guys in the back of an E-2 do. And whereas we as SWOs, are expected to do everything. And, I use those analogies of all the different jobs you can do in the air is kind of what we're expected to do here. And, it's hard to be innovative when you're running around every day trying to learn a new thing all the time throughout your entire career, just on and on and on and on, you know, 30 hours of work in a 24-hour day, and you're expected to be a specialist in everything, and it just doesn't work real well. I certainly think that models like the Royal Navy have, at least in the service community, you know, I know I'm pigeonholing this conversation a little bit, but I think that probably would foster a little bit more innovation because we would get to be experts in what we're doing, and we would know when something is broken, you know, a process is broken, that is, and we could innovate and make it better. Whereas here, you know, I'm expected, at least as a divo, I was expected to be just as intelligent about the 5-inch gun as I was about, you know, a lube oil purifier. And that's just not realistic. You know, I'm not going to be, that intelligent about it all. And you can't expect me to innovate something down in the plant when I'm expected to be equally as intelligent about driving in formation or being that ever critical plane guard for Ben's F-18 at night. You know, I think those types of things might help us out, specialization. I don't know exactly how we'd incorporate the jobs from, you know, what you do in college, but I think it certainly has merit to look at.
You know, let me throw one thing in there. I think maybe we're misusing a historical example. I don't believe in what I've read is that the British are actually a particularly good example because I don't think they ever did embrace that innovative culture. If you look at Nelson, Nelson only won, or was able to do what Nelson did because he won. If you look at the Battle of Cape St. Vincent, is that he went out, he completely disregarded orders, but he won. So they couldn't exactly go back and reprimand a guy who, who the battle rotated on his disobedience. And when it comes to that, is that if you look at other historical examples, is that it, they never really were innovative. So in a lot of cases, you wonder, certain individuals were able to do it. If you look at guys like, General Gordon or Admiral, Nelson, certain singular characters in the history, General Slim, those kinds of guys, they're able to do it because they win. What we're essentially talking about is a peacetime Navy, and we say peacetime, but, you know, there's still the coal, there was still the USS Firebolt in 2004, you know, there's still threats out there, but we're asking a force that is not in a full-fledged war to accept risk. And I don't, at least I haven't seen any examples where that ever actually happens. And it's interesting that we're trying to build that now, because I would say it's almost historically unique. And of course, my historical background is not as great as it could be, so I could be totally wrong, but, I mean, we might, what we're talking about here might be something particularly unique in at least in the case of large scale militaries.
I think you're right, man. I mean, I would never claim that the British Navy was at one point this paragon of innovation. But I think that we might be at an inflection point where this might be a historically unique moment that we could potentially have a peacetime force that could be with the generation that's coming about and the individuals who are senior leaders who have been in combat and have the experience to understand what creative solutions can bring to the table. I think that we could blaze the trail here and provide incredible value going forward. Now, getting back to the risk part, I mean, that's something that no peacetime military or even peacetime government is ever willing to accept, because the potential short-term costs are so great, and maybe we'll never, you know, get it over that hurdle. But there has to be ways, and I think one of the things that we have available to us is we could, with the technology out there, and I think SimSec had an article about this, we could do incredible things with war games that are computer-based, that allow us to have very specific scenario environments that we could just have officers experiment with. It wouldn't have to be, you know, outside the lifelines, but they could literally lose a whole battle fleet and experiment, and nothing would be lost but a little bit of time and some stray trons, and they learn from that. It gets back to the whole battle school thing in Ender's Game. When I first got in the Navy, I envisioned wargaming to be this great computer game that you could do, like, you know, thousands of iterations per day and figure out new ideas. Well, we're in 2013, and one of the most effective war games we have, and it is very effective, still takes 2 months to do 8 hours of moves. And to me, that is just mind-blowing. I mean, how can we not take commercial off-the-shelf technology, adapt it in a secret environment, and create a war game scenario that you and I can play while we're on deployment, because we all love war games, but that's realistic, and teach us fleet tactics, individual ship tactics, and larger strategic tactics, and fail, experiment, and even find new tactics that'll work out. We can do that stuff, but we haven't, so.
Just for everyone's reference, yeah, we did have an article up at SimSec about that. That was by Britt Perry, another great, an amazing Georgetown student. But the other scenario that I know of is NWDC runs its CSG 360, which I thought was a pretty cool experiment, and partially shocking, because I would have always assumed we would do something like that.
Yeah.
So innovative in the fact that we hadn't done it before, but disappointing in the fact that we'd never really done something to that scale to train people on the high level, or at least expose them to that rapid iteration of red teaming.
Well, yeah. I got to play that, and it was incredible. But the time frame, it took us 3 months to go through 8 hours of the game.
Sure.
I mean, and that, because it was all individual, and the individual people were evaluating every move, and all this stuff could be computerized. I mean, easily. This is like EA Games 101 here. Now, again, you have to put resources and money behind it, but, you know, if there was a push and demand for it, we could make it happen, but I just don't see that.
Let me say this one thing. As a guy who used to do Model UN, I do think that the CSG 360 model of having that personal input, while it does unnaturally give people a lot of time to think about their moves, which isn't going to happen, it is important to have that moment of interpretation with human beings. Because if you did put it into a video game, video games have this unfortunate or fortunate, depending how you think about it, tendency of doing exactly what you tell them to do. And in real life, human beings don't do that. And I did like the CSG 360 model because they did kind of run it a bit like – now, Ben, maybe you know better because you actually did it. But when it was described to me, it sounded far more like a Model UN scenario with military units than it did an exact – war game, which I think is good because it also encourages people not to have that micromanagement expectation. The last thing that we want to do is to start training flag officers to expect military units to react like a video game, where maybe there's a good point to that in the exercise realm. We train like we fight, and if we train guys to think, I'm just going to right-click and all my ships, and they're going to go over here, that would be a horrifying – I mean, we're already halfway there. to convince people that this is the way that it should go is probably – I love the idea of computerized war games, but sometimes I wonder if it gives people the wrong expectations or the wrong way of thinking about problems.
I think, you know, I got to watch the game you know, be created, and I've seen it go through several iterations. It's now called Strike Group 360 instead of Carrier Strike Group because it applies. We're getting the ESG guys on board, and they're playing the game as well.
Awesome.
I think that it's got two different functions. I think Ben's idea absolutely has merit, and I'm fully on board with that because Strike Group 360 is a little bit clunky. It's not a perfect product, but it's pretty good. I think it maybe teaches more baby steps about strategy, vice maybe in the moment tactics, which maybe I think a faster real time computer game type of, you know, a harpoon type of thing maybe would allow for. Now the, you know, important to note, you know, again, going back to my, you know, innovation cycle, you know, that happened, you know, the Strike Group 360 game kind of came out because the right guy was in the, you know, in the right command to make a difference at the time. You know, the admiral in charge there being a Strike Group guru himself and and I think Ben will certainly agree, basically a genius all around in everything he did.
Now, come on, guys. He doesn't necessarily listen to this podcast. So well, he can calm already, down a little bit.
You know, he's been gone for a while. So that theory rep signed a while ago. So, but, he created it in the moment there. And, they're, you know, working with the War College and they still play they still play their role in the game. But, it went from our conference room in the building there at NWDC to it's now been farmed out to every carrier strike group, every staff there, the admiral and his staff, are playing the game, during their training cycle. So it was a kind of a listen, implement, and publicize.
That's great. I did not know it had advanced that far. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, we're actually sending out teams to every strike group to help facilitate it. And then they play the game. Now, Ben's point is right. It's not a instant gratification. And I agree that the instant gratification piece, whether it was in that game or a different game to be named later, you know, it's one of the, you know, I know the Crick's working on that idea as well. I think it's got its merits, and I think it's getting them to think about, you know, what their moves out there will really play into. So one of the scenarios they go through, we'll keep it clean level here for this conversation, but, you know, it's certainly in an area of the world where a lot of us have deployed to, and certainly in an area in the world that's in the news a lot right now. And, you know, hearing some of these admirals come out from the conference room, they'll come by my desk and say, well, I just lost 3 DDGs. You know, I parked them right on top of a so-and-so country's submarine and they're all gone. And holy crap, you know, I never had to think about losing, 700 guys and, you know, $3 billion worth of, you know, Navy equipment. And not to mention, you know, huge part of my punching power, there. You know, I probably would do that differently now. You know, things like that, you know, that it's got its merits there. I think that it was an innovative, idea. And it's been implemented, and I think Ben's process and what he's talking about would also be beneficial especially if we could be out there, you know, we have a few free moments out there in the fleet. We're doing the mission in the moment. We're like, you know what? Let me play the counter piracy scenario on this, you know, XYZ game that he's come up with. And let me mess around with it a little bit. And, you know, and I come up with a solution or something like that. You know, I don't know if the Navy data mines it and gets the information and doctrine changes, but nonetheless, I think it would have a lot of value.
Well, this has been a great discussion. We are getting to the top of the hour here, so I don't want to keep everybody. It's pretty late now, and it's right before work day. So, gentlemen, do you have any closing comments, any closing thoughts, anything you want to plug, of course? Ben, I imagine you'll plug the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell. You do have the CRIC X as well, which I'm sure everyone's always welcome to. John, I don't know if you have anything. So each one of you guys, final observation, final thought, and anything that you want to plug for our listeners.
Well, Matt, thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate your time and letting us come on. Last thing I just have to say is this is just the beginning. I mean, we're going to go through a lot of iterations. We're going to have failures. We're going to have conversations like this. But the movement is growing, and there is an incredible groundswell of very intelligent, creative, and action-oriented individuals at all levels that are coming out of the woodwork that have been doing great things for the past 10 years. We're just going to continue to go forward in the next 10 or 20 years and continue to make an impact. So.
Yeah, and I would agree, and I would just offer for folks to take part in the conversation. Don't keep your head down. Don't feel like, you know, big Navy is crushing you. Get out there. If you see a problem, you know, think of a good way to solve it and, you know, and push it up there. Make the Navy tell you no. And when they do, fight back against it. And if it's really going to make life better, it's going to make us, you know, accomplish the mission better. It's going to keep our folks safer. Things like that, put the elbow grease in there and lean into it.
Absolutely, and like we were talking about before, is we are looking at a very unique moment in history. And, of course, not just out there in the fleet trying to implement these innovations and push them up. Feel free to write. CIMSEC, Center for International Maritime Security, is always a forum. We're open to folks out there that have innovative ideas. We don't just talk about policy and ship types. We're totally open to folks wanting to write about really simple solutions they find out there on the deck plates. And willing to post them up here on the next war blog. As always, gentlemen, it was a pleasure. If anyone out there wants to subscribe, we are available on iTunes, Xbox Music, and Stitcher Stream Radio. If you have an extra moment and you subscribe to the show, I'd really invite you to go on there and give us a rating. Tell us what you think. And of course, you can always email me at nextwar@simsec.org, and you can find us on Twitter @simsec, and you can find us online at www.simsec.org. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.